Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 135. I'm recording it on Tuesday, May 5th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 15. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The name of this particular selection is Bumbly March. The title of the podcast is Today's Stock Price Reflects Our Assessments of the Past, Present, and Future. In an ideal world, this is a podcast I would not need to record. Why? The subject of this podcast is today's stock price. I'm going to be talking about what influences the stock price, if you look at the Dow average for today, or the S&P average, and these things, of course, are reported relentlessly in the newspapers and the television programs and the radio programs. And we should not care. We should not care. Today's stock price is irrelevant to your effort to achieving financial freedom. You should not care about today's stock price. So, there's a part of me that would like to just say, why should I waste an hour of my time recording a podcast about today's stock price and then hope that some of my listeners will waste an hour of their time listening to it when the topic doesn't matter? The reality, of course, is that we do not live in an ideal world. This stuff is shoved down our throats by newspapers and radio programs and television programs. And the reason why it's shoved down our throats, there's more than one reason, but the primary reason is we all have a weakness. We all are drawn, our attention is drawn to financial porn and discussions of why the stock price is what it is today is our financial porn. We're drawn to we listen to reports of which baseball team won yesterday. There, the daily reports mean something. If your team wins a baseball game, it increases their chances of winning the pennant. So the short term means something. It has significance. It's proper and right and just that people report on the scores of the games on a daily basis. The only information that it would make sense to report on a daily basis that I can think of having to do with investing would be possibly the PE10 level. And of course, you can't find that. That tells you how, what matters is how you invest for the long term. And the PE10 level at least gives you guidance on what you should be doing on a long-term basis, so the PE10 value has some significance. Even there, it should not be overdone. One of the questions I get most often at the site is, where do I find out this PE10 level? You're always talking about PE10 levels, Rob, but where do I find it? Where's it reported? And that causes, you know, I instantly have two reactions when I'm asked that question. One is, what a world we live in, where millions of middle-class workers are investing in stocks to finance their retirements, and they can't find the PE10 level. The most important bit of information you need to know, the price tag on the stocks you buy. You can't find it. And it's not the fault of these people who write me. I've checked myself. Run a Google search. This will blow your mind. Run a Google search. Go to Google and type in PE10. PE/10. And see what comes up. The last time I checked, you know who the number one site is on PE10 in Google? PassionSaving.com. I'm the king. John Walter Russell, not far behind. I think he's in the number two spot. Maybe he switches to number one from time to time. We're the two at the top. That makes me happy, but it's also sick because my site is not the biggest financial site on the internet, and John's isn't either. There's one or two sites a little bigger, a little higher in the rankings, let's say. So those are the sites that should be coming up first. That's the way Google does it. But those sites aren't talking about PE10. They've got millions of dollars behind them, but they're not giving you the information you need to invest effectively for the long term. If you don't know the PE10 level, you don't know the price tag of the stocks you buy. And if you don't know the price tag, you shouldn't be buying. Would you buy a car without looking at the price tag? Would you buy a house without knowing what the asking price is? Would you buy a comic book without knowing the price? Or a banana? So, it's bad. It's a bad sign that the PE10 level is not reported everywhere. But the second reaction I have to that is people shouldn't be asking this, because while it should, the PE10 level should be reported everywhere. It should be common knowledge. It also is not something that you should need to consult that often. And I think what happens is I talk about PE10 levels. I talk about how important they are, and some poor souls every now and again thinks maybe I have a little idea what I'm talking about, and they think, yeah, I want to check out that PE10. And they start thinking the way to check out PE10 is the same way, you know, today you check out things like the Dow average or the S&P or whatever it is, or reports of what happened yesterday and why and all this gibberish. And it doesn't work like that. You need to know that the way to learn how to use this material is to go to the calculators at the website, go to the scenario surfer, and go through a 30-year return sequence, choose a stock allocation every year, and see if you can do so intelligently and if you can get good results out of the calculator. And in order to run through one of those scenarios, you need to know the PE10 level. The calculator will report it for you, what it is at the beginning of each year under these hypothetical scenarios. But you only need to check it once a year. You check it January 1st of the year. You can go 365 days without worrying about it. You know, and it wouldn't hurt if you knew it, you know, if you checked it every 3 months or something. But you shouldn't be checking it every day. That's the point. Now, the point is you should try to be a long-term investor. And we are now in a twilight zone. I often state my belief that we are, our knowledge of how investing works is primitive. I'm very happy that in recent days I've seen a number of comments on discussion boards saying just that our knowledge today is primitive. And it makes me very happy when I see that. In other words, people are catching on to the idea. It's not a flood of people, but a few. And they're catching on to the idea that the real problem, it isn't even a question of good advice versus bad advice. It's just that virtually no one knows what they're talking about. That's the real problem. And so the first thing we need to develop in order to move forward is some humility. If we develop some humility, we could take this to wonderful places. I want to get into the meat of this podcast, but it just hit me when I started mentioning those. One of the posts that just blew me away. This is the I nominate this as the best post I have ever seen in an investing discussion in 7 years of discussions of the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate. I saw it this morning at bogleheads.org. It's by a guy, I've seen his name before, but I'm not super familiar with him. I have no idea how to pronounce it. Nisiprius, Nisiprius. He's got 5,300 posts at the Bogleheads board. That's a few. And under location, he says, North America, Western Hemisphere, the Earth, the Solar System, the Universe, the Mind of God. So, okay. Sounds like a good guy to me. Good guy or good woman. And man, this is a post. You won't see this written up on any of the quote-unquote experts. I'm going to read you this post because this is my favorite post of all time. The big problem is that it's hard to know the right answer. The word know is in bold. We are talking about investing for, quote, a lifetime. And the data in, for example, the widely used Ibbotson SBBI yearbooks only cover a couple of lifetimes at best. That's true. In the absence of real knowledge, the gap gets filled by people who sound knowledgeable. This is the whole story of investing in the year 2009. Any financial expert can dazzle and baffle me by proving that they know 20 times as many detailed facts about which broker has the best bid-ask spread on a covered call, on a reverse convertible debenture, or the ratio between United Widget's current account and its senior debt obligations. Man, this guy is on fire. This is the truth, friends and neighbors. Having established that he knows far more than I do, I'm softened up and likely to believe that his pronouncements on what will do well over the next couple of years are knowledgeable too. Man, I love it when somebody's on fire. Every punch connects. 99% of what we hear about investing is just the confident-sounding pronouncement of authoritative-sounding people with good presentation skills. People who listen to each other and self-organize themselves into schools of thought. This is blood on the tracks. Only a tiny... This guy, I'm going to have to quote this guy in my book. This guy's blowing me away. Every time I read it, it gets better. Only a tiny amount of it is directly data-based at all. Sound bites are repeated over and over again. A good example is, quote, anyone investing in the stock market in 1929 who was able to hold on recovered by 1936. It's far from completely true. And it's far from completely untrue, but it gets repeated over and over again by people who obviously haven't even bothered to glance at a chart. One of the things that's so stimulating about this very news group is the willingness of people to test some pronouncement or bit of wisdom by at least going out and glancing at actual data. Some convincing talkers are outright con artists. Some, for example, 401k plan providers, are merely salesmen. They have an honest product with legitimate uses, and they surround it with a dazzling halo of half-truths, making it look better than it is. Like the proverbial IBM salesman, they may not even know they're lying. What a trip. And he has an asterisk there, and you read the asterisk, and it says, question, what's the difference between a used car salesman and an IBM salesman? Answer, the used car salesman knows he's lying. That is true. No, straight no chaser. The used car salesman knows he's lying. Some convincing talkers are like a doctor in the 1800s. They may be completely sincere and really have their client's best interest at heart. And their sincerity and bedside manner carries conviction. But, unfortunately, nevertheless, applying leeches mostly doesn't work. Even if we assume the past history is some kind of guide, if no guarantee of future performance, we don't have enough past history to go on. Professor Siegel knows that the real return of stocks in the United States has been, quote, extraordinarily stable over the 200 years researchers have traced it. But it has taken 200 years to accumulate that data, and nobody knows whether the stock market of today, in bold, is the same thing as it has been. By the time you have enough data, the world has had enough time to change. Man. Love it. I love that post. That's the truth about stock investing and Rob Bennett's opinion. And it's relevant. It's a little bit of a you know, sideways road on this podcast, but not entirely. What he's saying is it's a different way of saying what I've been saying, that our knowledge of investing today is primitive. And what we need to do is throw out what we think we know but isn't true, all the stuff we think we know that isn't true. We need to throw in the garbage can. Then we need to start over. And we need to have an honest, sincere, informed, reasoned, civil discussion about how stock investing works, because our economy can't work unless middle-class investors at least have a clue, and they can't get a clue until the experts get a clue, and the experts can't get a clue until they learn how to say those three magic words, "I was wrong." And then when we do that, we can start moving forward, and I think there'll be a lot of wonderful stuff to move forward on. But this whole focus on today's stock price is a mistake. It's a mistake. And it's easy enough to understand why a middle-class person would do it. You know, we're all weak. We're all drawn to the short term. Nothing strange or hard to understand about that. The problem is not that we are weak. That's just a fact of life, and there's not a thing we can do about it. It's complaining about that is like complaining about a mountain being in the way of your path when you want to drive somewhere. The mountain's there. You can complain about it and cry about it. Doesn't change anything. What we need to do is dig a road through the mountain or dig a pass. And to do that, we have to acknowledge the mountain. We have to acknowledge the problem. The problem is most people in the stock selling industry are, surprise, surprise, trying to make a buck. Nothing wrong with making a buck. Our country is built on the idea that we all have a right to go out and make a buck. But we have to acknowledge that. We can't pretend that they're out here, out of the goodness of their hearts trying to help us invest effectively. They're trying to make a buck. And during out-of-control bull markets, they tell us what we want to hear, not what works. They tell us what we want to hear, which is the opposite of what works. The opposite of what works. So they tell us to focus on the short term. Now, there's a wonderful man, goes by the name of John Bogle, Saint Jack to his friends, of which I am one. I don't call him Saint Jack, but I understand the idea. The wonderful man named Jack Bogle, who started promoting the idea of long-term investing to help the middle-class investor, a long-term approach that is also simple, and what potential that idea has. But John Bogle, because he's not actually a saint, he really is one of us humans too, he made a few mistakes on the way, and one of them was a real doozy, and the real doozy was He fell for the efficient market theory. He fell for the idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation when prices go to insanely dangerous levels. He fell for the passive investing concept. And that concept is a short-term concept, not a long-term concept. So while Bogle's approach has a lot of long-term language, when it gets down to brass tacks, what you're talking about is short-term investing. And so what I'm talking about today is short-term thinking. And I don't want you to do this. I don't want you to think short term. The purpose of this podcast is to explain why focusing on the short term is a big waste of time. It's worse than a waste of time. It's dangerous. So I'm really just trying to cancel out things that you're hearing from Bogle followers and from Bogle himself, and even from people who are pre-Bogle. The question is, what does today's stock price signify? What is it? What is it? And the rational investing answer is it's nonsense. It's gibberish. It's meaningless. Just don't even be enticed to look at it. Or if you're going to look at it, adjust for valuations. Because if you adjust for valuations, it at least becomes a meaningful figure. If you adjust for valuations, at least you're looking at a real number, something that has some significance. Although I still don't think you should be jumping around with your allocation. I advocate changing allocations in response to big shifts in price, but I say that you only need to do that roughly once every 10 years. It's certainly not something you need to do at all often. So I wouldn't be spending time on this short-term stuff. I'd be spending time. All you really need to do is spend a little bit of time learning how investing works, the ABCs. If you do that, you can pretty much just go on with your life from that point forward. And if you want to learn how to pick individual stocks, do that by all means. But It's not, you don't have to do it. It's not required. But I'm going to talk about what goes into today's stock price with the goal of persuading you not to care what it is. And when I talk about today's stock price, I'm talking about the price of a broad index, the S&P or the Dow. The title of the podcast is, Today's Stock Price Reflects Our Assessments of the Past, Present, and Future. Now, the passive model, the passive idea about what goes into today's stock price is, it's all rooted in something called the efficient market theory, which is rooted in an economic myth called the rational man or the economic man. And if we were all rational creatures, what role would the past have in setting today's stock price? Zero. The past is gone. It's not rational for something that happened a year ago or 2 years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago to affect the stock price. But it does, in reality. So says Rob Bennett. One of the things that comes up, people will say, today, they'll say, you know, people will look at these programs that are going through, or they'll look at, you know, some kind of development. They'll say, oh, the market approves of this. Look, the stock price is going up. That doesn't mean that the market approves of such and such a thing. The market was insanely overpriced for 13 years, 1995 through 2008. The market doesn't become rational in one day. The price doesn't go from, you know, we were at one time a PE 10 level of 44. We're now at fair value, PE 10 of 15. The market doesn't go from a PE 10 level of 44 to a PE 10 level of 15 in one day. It doesn't wake up and say, I feel I'm in a rational mood today. I've been in an insane mood for a few years now, but today I'm feeling rational. It's not the way it works. It happens in stages. It takes years. It can take, I don't know if I want to say decades, but it can take years. You know, if there was a word for five-year time period, you could say it takes several of them. It can take 10 years or 15 years. I don't think it's ever taken much more than 20. But it can take a long time. So we were at the highest price level ever in history in January of 2000. It's now May of 2009, and we still may have a long ways to go. Now, we're at fair value. So in economic terms, we're where we need to be. Economic terms, the battle's been won. It's over. But the trouble is the market is backward-looking. The market is us. Let's start with that. You know, people talk about the market like it's an abstraction. It's this machine up in the sky that generates stock numbers. The market is us. The market is people. That's what a market is. It's us. We have the power. So we set the stock price. Every day we do this. And one of the things we keep in mind in setting the stock price is, what was the stock price last year? And what was the stock price 5 years ago? And what was the stock price 10 years ago? All of those, what was the stock price 20 years ago? All of those things are affecting it. Why? Because some of us, I say we are the market, but we're not all alike. Some of us started investing in 1990, almost 20 years ago. And some of us started investing in 2000, almost 10 years ago. And some of us started investing in 2005, almost 5 years ago. And some of us started investing 3 months ago. We're a mix. And depending on when you started investing, that affects what today's stock price is, or it affects what your take on it is. And your take has an influence. Every single investor affects the stock price, every single one. So if you started investing 20 years ago and you had super returns all through the 90s, there's a part of your mind that says the price should be higher today than it is, because you grew accustomed to prices higher than fair value, and you haven't yet accepted that that's not the real world. If you started investing in 2000, that's probably not so. If you started investing in 2000, you're probably pretty darn disgusted by now. But the past may still be affecting you. It doesn't mean the past doesn't affect you. It affects you in the opposite way from how it affects the guy who started investing in 90. Because for you, you've had 9 bad years, and you're fed up, and you're disgusted, and you've reached a point where you say, stocks stink. Stocks never, never give good returns, and you affect today's stock price, possibly by getting out, possibly because you're so disgusted, you'll sell at any darn price you can get. And if you got in a few months ago, you might even have the opposite take. You might have, if you only started investing 3 months ago, you might have came into it with a fresh mind, and you have no interest in passive investing because that's for old fogies. You're 25 and you're hot to trot, and you start reading about all the people that are coming out now saying all the conventional investing advice is nonsense. The conventional advice of the last 30 years, the passive investing era. I saw a quote from Warren Buffett this morning. I follow these. Warren Buffett, what was his word? Oh, now I forget. Nutty, nutty. The conventional investing advice is quote-unquote nutty, says Warren Buffett. The efficient market theory is nutty. Now they tell us. So maybe you got in 3 months ago, and you see that Warren Buffett thinks it's nutty, and Rob Arnott, had a statement a week or two ago where he said the conventional investing advice of today is myth and urban legend. You listen to Robert Shiller, he said he's been intimidated from telling the truth for years. He would be viewed as unprofessional if he said everything he knows about stock investing. So you've read these sorts of comments and you've said, conventional advice is obviously bonkers, but this is an opportunity for me. Because now if the conventional advice is exposed, stocks can go up again. So maybe you're looking back only 3 months, and looking back 3 months, stocks look pretty good. So if you look back 20 years, you haven't yet accepted that the price should be where it is. So you still got this little rooting in your heart. You're waiting to be crushed. Your heart hasn't yet been fully crushed yet. You're hanging on. The next big stock crash, you'll give up, but you're not there yet. You're still hanging on to passive. And then the guy 10 years back, he's disgusted. He's out of stocks, zero. He's pulling the price lower than it should be. And then the guy that got in 3 months ago is thinking, I got this all figured out. And he looks backward and he thinks the price should be higher than it is. But he doesn't have, he thinks it should be higher, just like the guy that started in 90. But the difference is the guy that started in 90 is going to bail in the next crash. But the guy who's just getting in now might not bail because he hasn't suffered. He knows the history. He knows that prices have gone down from 2000, but he didn't lose real money in it. So to him, it's sort of a theoretical thing. So another stock crash, he might, if he starts putting money in now, he'll lose a little bit, but it won't be that big a deal. And he actually will get good returns for investing in stocks today, whereas the guy from 90 is going to get pulverized by staying in. So the market price is backward looking. It's looking back to the past, because that's how humans are. Humans have awareness of what's going on in the present, memories of what has happened in the past, and anticipation of what's going to happen in the future. And humans set stock prices. The market is us. We do this thing. It's not done to us. There's no machine. There's no stock price generating machine. We do it. So if you want to know how stock prices are set, you better learn something about how humans go about forming their assessments of what things are worth. And we do it by factoring in current observation, memories of the past, and anticipations of the future. Today's stock price is a combination of those three things. So it's backward looking. Now, passive say that's impossible. That shouldn't be. Not rational. Not efficient. Well, too bad us humans can't live up to their expectations. We should all write them a big apology. But that's the way we are. If you want to know how stock investing works in the real world, take a look at who owns stocks in the real world. It's not economic man. It's not rational man. It's humans. This is how humans. I'm telling you how humans do it. The futurists discount it. This is the passive idea about the future. The passives will say, oh, the market is forward-looking. They say it's not backward-looking, but they acknowledge that it's forward-looking. They say, oh, we discount future earnings. We think about what the companies are going to generate, and we discount it. A great theory. Very, very nicely done. And God knows how many articles have been written about this theory of discounted future returns. The only problem is humans aren't capable of doing that. Who's doing all this discounting? There was a great story about this in the book I did a podcast on not too long ago that Robert Shiller and Akerlof did. Animal Spirits. And they talked in their class. You know, they teach a class at Yale, and they at least Shiller does. I don't know where Akerlof teaches. Somewhere. He does teach. He may be retired. I think he's retired. But they talked about a class where they were talking about saving to their students. And they were sort of testing out, you know, how do they discount? How, you know, they always talk about the compounding returns, and if you choose to spend, you get this much. But if you delay gratification, you get this much. And they sort of tested their students on, you know, to what extent, you know, how they decide which is more important, delay gratification, blah blah blah. And the students don't have a clue about any of this stuff. Could care less. It's all great for the classroom. Fill up lots of, you know, use up lots of chalk and erasers writing all these formulas on the blackboard. But it has zero to do with what goes on in the real world. There's nobody actually doing it. The students aren't doing it, and the grown-ups aren't doing it. Who's doing it? Who's doing this stuff? You know, they'll tell you, if you increase the 401k match, you'll increase saving by X amount. You would. If anybody was paying attention to what the rate was they were getting, but just about nobody is. So it's all, you know, as Rob Arnott puts it, myth and urban legend. We're discounting the future, discounting future dividend streams. If we were all rational actors, sure, we would discount future revenue streams. But we don't even know how to do it. Most of us. So if we don't know how to do it, how's it getting done? That's not what's happening. Now, I had a great example of this. I don't know if I should read the whole letter. I don't think I have time. But boy, did I have a great example of this morning. I have a neighbor. His name is Jim. And he called me a week or two ago and asked me, he's you know, I don't know the details, but he's looking at putting some money into either treasuries or TIPS. Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, and we talked a little bit on the phone, and then he wrote me an email. I saw it in my inbox this morning, and he listened to somebody, he didn't say who, somebody on a finance radio show, and the guy said, I don't have the numbers exactly right, but I'll give you rough. He said, the TIPS rate, was maybe 1.8, something like that, 10-year TIPS, and he was talking, you know, real return, and then he was saying the treasury number was something like 3.2, so that would be a difference of 1.4. And he was saying that this radio guru, personal finance guru, was saying, oh, the market is saying that there's a difference of 1.4. You know, if you give up the inflation protection, you get 1.4 extra return. Therefore, the market is assuming that we're going to have a long-term inflation rate of something around 1.4. And so my neighbor was asking me, does this make sense to you? You know, what do you think? And I wrote him a fairly long email. I think I'm going to post it at the website, at the blog, because I thought it was interesting. It was an interesting question. And the answer is, you know, I don't think the radio guy had it 100% right. He didn't include every factor, but generally what he was saying made sense. It logically made sense. But it's all assuming that the market is rational, and I dispute that. This is why I'm controversial. I say it's not so. People aren't doing this. They're not saying, oh, I think inflation's going to be 1.4, you know, so I'm willing to buy treasuries at 3. Oh, heaven help us. It's just not the way it's done. That's the theory. That's the efficient market theory. That is the theory. It's just not true. It just doesn't work that way. Now, what's really going on? You know, you could. That's basically what this podcast is about. How do they set those prices? It's past, present, and future. The people in the tips market are influenced just like the people in stocks, and they're influenced by what kind of returns they got in past years. If the people in tips have been getting great returns for a long time, they're fat and happy, and they're not going to demand that much. And if they've gotten poor returns, they're fed up, and they're leaving tips, and no matter how great a deal you offer them, they're not interested. That's human nature. And that applies buying tips and buying treasuries, just like it applies buying comic books and bananas. You've got to look at how people feel, because that's what sets the price. Anyone who's trying to sell you anything knows this. You know, if a company gets a bad reputation for customer service, they can cut their prices to the bone and people won't buy. But a company like Apple, you know, that's been putting out good electronics products, the iPod and all this sort of thing, people are lined up. The day they come out with a new iPod, you go to the mall and these people are lined up out of the store before it opens because they want the latest, coolest thing. It's emotion. There's nothing wrong. I'm not criticizing it. I'm just saying it's real. And this efficient market theory just, you know, with a wave of the hand, does away with it. So the market, is the market saying that inflation is going to be 1.4? I suppose you could say, you could interpret it that way. The market is like a opinion poll that these politicians take. You know, is Bush a good president? You take it, you know, a week after 9/11, and he had the highest ratings in history. You take it, you know, a week before the last election, and he had the lowest in history. And there's only a difference there of, you know, 7 years. So in 7 years, he goes from being the best president in history to being the worst? No. He had his good points and his bad points, you know, in 2001, and he had his good points and his bad points in 2008. But people were emotional. They were pulling for him after 9/11 because he was the president and it was a patriotic moment. And they were down on him in November of 2008 because they lost their retirement money and they weren't happy with the guy in charge. Now, all this makes a certain amount of sense. But what I'm saying is you can't look at an opinion poll and think this is going to tell you whether Bush is going to have a successful presidency or not. It's measuring an emotion. It's an ephemeral thing. It's the same thing with a market price. It's an ephemeral thing. So it's not telling you anything of lasting significance. You know, he could buy those treasuries thinking inflation is only going to be 1.4, and a year from now, that differential could be 10 percentage points. The market, the quote-unquote market, which is just us, could decide that the differential needs to be 10 percentage points because inflation is going to be huge. And then what's he going to do with his 10-year investment? He's got his money tied up in it. You can't go by that. People are trying to piggyback on quote-unquote the market, thinking that the market is this genius, and the market is just us. The market's no genius. The market is just as smart as we are. And when we're all trying to piggyback on the market, we're not very smart because we're not even thinking. People who follow the efficient market theory give up thinking as their first act. They say, I'm going to assume the market knows. I'm not even going to bother to try to figure out what the price of stock should be or the price of tips or the price of treasuries or the price of anything else. Well, if you don't even bother, guess what? You come up with a dumb answer. And right now we're pushing this on people. We've got millions of people following dumb answers. We're encouraging dumbness. And we're getting it. We're getting what we encourage. So I better move on. You know, I have here calculators. The stock return predictor tells you what the likely long-term return on stocks is using a regression analysis on the historical stock return data. It assumes that the average long-term return is going to remain 6.5% real. That's what it's been through history. Is that assumption true? It's not necessarily true. I get that all the time. People say, how do you know it's going to be 6.5? I don't. I just use that as a starting point. I think it's the most logical place to start because it historically has been true for a long, long time. But if you think stocks are going to do better than they ever have in the past, by all means, add something to those numbers. And if you think stocks are going to do worse than they ever have in the past, by all means, subtract something. What I'm rebelling against is the idea that the passives push, which is just to assume that 6.5 applies at all valuation levels. And that idea, I believe, is insane, or as Warren Buffett would say, nutty. A nutty idea. Or as Rob Arnott would say, it's a myth, an urban legend. Why would you think it would always be 6.5? It's 6.5 if the price is fair, and if the price is high, obviously it's going to be less than that. If the price is low, obviously the return's going to be greater than that. So when you're looking at today's price, the point here is the price is set by emotion, and the price is set by looking backward, looking at today, at what's happening today, and looking forward. The beauty of that 6.5 number, there's a magic in that. I think he used to, Attalos, my friend Attalos, at the Goon Central board, he used to call it the magic tool. He was mocking me, but it is a magic tool, the 6.5 number. The magic of it is it forces you to think long term. If we were rational, the stock price would always be something close to fair value, and the long-term return would always be something close to 6.5 real. Why? Because whenever prices got higher than fair price, we would do this thing that the efficient market theory says we're supposed to do. We would discount for the future. We would say, hey, prices can't be sustained at this level, obviously, so stocks aren't as good as usual, so I'm going to sell a little bit. And if we all did that, that would always pull prices down. It would pull them down enough so that the return would go up. And then we'd be back at that 6.5 number. In other words, that 6.5 number really is magic. It's where the U.S. It tells you where the stock price should be. It should be at whatever number generates a long-term return of 6.5 real. And the market is self-regulating. If we would educate people about how it works, the market would in fact do that. It would always stay some. It wouldn't stay exactly 6.5, but it would stay in that neighborhood. But once you start telling people they can invest passively, that they don't need to sell when prices go insane, well, you're taking the brakes off the car. You're just taking the brakes and just cutting them off. And it can work for a while. You know, you're driving down the highway 70 miles an hour. Everything seems fine. It's a sunny day. But what happens when there's a slowdown and you've got a brake and the brakes have been ripped out of your car? That's passive investing. The only way the market can ever adjust its price is by having people sell stocks. And the passive investing people are telling us we don't need to sell. We ripped the brakes out of the car. That's why we had a stock crash. That's why we have an economic crisis. But the beauty of thinking about things in those terms is that it forces rationality. It forces you to look long term. You should be thinking, this is the return that is right for stock. 6.5 is right in some sense, because that's what it's always been. So if I see that the price of stocks is so high that the long-term return is a negative 1%, there's something wrong, something rotten in the state of Denmark. The humans have messed up again, and we've got to get the message out. We've got to help them out. We've got to start telling people that we're in one of those states where passive investing became popular again, and we're headed for a huge stock crash. And once we experience the stock crash, the beauty of it is you don't have to keep selling. We're back at normal now. We shouldn't have to keep selling. The problem is we've hyped people up with all this emotion, with all this fairy tale stuff about how, you know, you can't predict the future, nobody knows, stocks could return anything. And that now, you know, they used that to sell stocks for 13 years when they were overpriced. But now that same message is causing people to get rid of their stocks. Not to buy them, but to get rid of them. Because now it scares people that the future's not predictable. But the future has always been predictable. Not 100%. But it's always been largely predictable. And if we had been telling people all along it's predictable, people would accept that it's predictable now, and we wouldn't be in the jam we're in today. The old model was the bull bear market cycle. You know, I often speak out against passive investing, but I also don't support the old bull bear cycle. Passive investing just really exaggerated that, is what happened. It took the old bull bear cycle and exaggerated it, made it worse than ever. And it did that by pretending, I don't say intentionally, but pretending essentially that there's some sort of scientific support for passive investing. And so people have always had this inclination to want to ignore price when stocks are overpriced. And passive investing gave them the greatest excuse in history for doing just what their emotions tell them to do. So what we need to do is to reverse that. What we need is, you know, there have been hundreds of millions of dollars spent promoting passive investing. What we need to get our economy back on track is to spend hundreds of millions promoting rational investing, not passive investing. Promote how it works. Get the message out to people about how it really works. And then middle-class investors will become more and more confident. They will become less afraid of stocks. They will understand what they're doing. They won't give in to these nutty ideas, these myths and urban legends. That would be true long-term investing. And, you know, people then would be, see the beauty, I've said this before, but the beauty of valuation-informed indexing, the beauty of the stock return predictor is every uptick in price is both good news and bad news. If stocks go up 6.5% real a year, the long-term return stays the same, because that's the return you should be getting. That's the magic number. If they go up more than that, you get a short-term benny, you know, you get a short-term little jolt in your portfolio, but your long-term return goes down. So the one is matched by the other. And if you get a short-term drop, if you don't get 6.5 for 1 year, less than that, you get a short-term hurt, short-term negative, but your long-term return goes up a little bit. So you get a short-term jolt. I mean, a long-term jolt. And the two always match. So what's happening is every change in the market is both positive and negative. Every change outside of 6.5 real. The 6.5 real, you know, that's what you're supposed to get. So, you know, that doesn't cause you a jolt in either direction. That just meets your expectations. But if you get more than that, you get pulled down. So your emotions don't run away with you. And if you get less than that, you get pulled up. So your emotions don't run away with you. And guess what that all amounts to? What it really amounts to is rational man. In other words, the ultimate goal of rational investing is to create the rational man. The problem with the passive approach is they assume it. They don't create it. They assume it. It's like the difference between, you know, you want a house to live in, and you walk to the spot where you want the house, and the passive investor says, I imagine a house. And then he goes to bed at night, you know, he lays down and pulls the covers up, and it rains on top of him. He doesn't get what he thought he assumed it doesn't make it happen. The rational investor, you know, gets out a hammer and nails and starts building a house, and one fine day, he's able to lay down under the covers, and it rains, and the rain, you know, makes, you know, sounds on the roof, but it doesn't touch him. Because the rational investor is dealing with reality, not the assumptions. Not the assumptions of rationality. He actually goes about developing tools to help him become rational. It's a journey. It's a quest. It's not an assumption. Not an assumption. You can always show correlations. Prices are not random. You know, the thing that is confusing about stock investing, all of the things I'm saying are simple. I don't offer anything complex. Partly because I don't think it is what is needed. I think what we need is simple, easy to understand investing advice. But partly because I can't understand it. It gets too complicated. It's over my head. But there's a couple little things about stock investing that make it strange, and it throws people off. And if you spend just a little bit of time thinking it through, you can figure it out. But if you don't, you get thrown off track, and that's the end of you. Especially if the experts are shoving this other stuff down your throat, and if you believe them. Stocks perform, I believe. I mean, this is just my opinion. Everything I say, that's the case. But stocks perform in understandable ways. But what's a little tricky is people have this idea that it's random. There's a random number generator in the sky, and the numbers just sort of descend upon us. The reason I think why they have that is there is no one rule that explains stock prices. For example, some people will say there's momentum. When stock prices start going up, they continue going up. And when they start going down, they continue going down. Everybody's noticed momentum. So some people come to believe in momentum. And then they get killed. They think, oh, prices always go up. They invest heavily in stocks. And then what happens? They go down. Just at the time they get persuaded, too. It happens a lot that way. So momentum doesn't, it seems to work for long periods of time, and then it doesn't. And other people believe in just the opposite. Other people believe in what they call contrarian investing. And they say, don't do what others are doing. Don't do what the crowd's doing. Always do the opposite, because they learned. They tried momentum. They got killed. They said, when I tried momentum, I always ended up buying in just as it was about to fall. I always got crushed. I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to be contrarian. And then they say, this is what people did in 95. They said, oh, prices are so high. Stocks, everybody loves them. The contrarian thing is to go short. And they got killed too, because stocks just kept going up. The problem is both rules apply and both rules don't fully apply. And the two rules conflict. There really is momentum. Why is there momentum? Because today's stock price is determined by emotion. And we all watch what others are doing. All humans watch what others are doing and follow. So when all our friends and neighbors and coworkers and fellow community members are out there buying stocks and making money, we do the same. We jump in. That's momentum. But the problem is momentum is self-destroying, self-limiting. You can only have so much momentum. Why? Because ultimately the market is efficient. It's not efficient on the first day, like the passive investing enthusiasts say it is, but it is efficient in the long term. Ultimately, the market price must reflect reality. It must, or the market will collapse. So you get this momentum going on for however many years, up, 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 you know, with little downs mixed in. But the little downs don't amount to anything. That's why they say buy on the dip, you know. Buy on the dip because the little downs don't mean anything. It goes down for a week and then it's up again. Up, 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 up is the rule, the long-term rule, as long as momentum applies. But because stocks are not just an emotional phenomenon, they're also a rational phenomenon. They have to obey the economic laws of the universe. When the price gets absurdly high, you can no longer, you've already earned all the returns. You've already cashed them all in. You know, by the year 2000, we had cashed them all in. There was no more returns to distribute. So what happens then? If we were rational, prices would just fall in one day. You'd have a massive crash. But we're not. When prices get high enough that you can no longer, that, you know, the long-term return is a negative number, as happened in January of 2000, what happens is stocks begin providing a negative return, so every year you lose a little bit. And that makes some people disgusted. But again, it only makes some. Different people are disgusted to different levels. You looked at January 2003. Stocks had provided poor returns for 3 years. Well, if you had been investing going back to 82, you really weren't too upset by that. You're saying, yeah, well, I'm not happy, but, I'm so far ahead of the game, it doesn't really bother me. I'm sticking. It didn't influence your behavior. But if you had started investing in 2000, as lots of people did, stocks were getting heavily promoted in the late 90s, so a lot of people jumped in. in 2000. And some people just reached an age where they had money to invest. They didn't have it in 82, but they had it in 99 or 2000. So those people were unhappy, and those people started to sell. So you had different emotional reactions among different investors. So the price didn't go down hard because you had all those old-timers who were sticking with their high stock allocations, but the price did go down because all the newcomers were fed up. They didn't like it that they weren't getting the returns they thought they were going to get. So the momentum, it's all a game of momentum, momentum, momentum until prices are so high you can't create any more momentum. Because when prices are high, returns are low. And when the return turns to a negative number, you just can't get any more momentum. So then the momentum starts to gradually go the other direction. That's called reversion to the mean. That's where the contrarians start to make out. But see, it doesn't happen all at once. Because each day, the price is set both by memory of the past, anticipation of the future, and appreciation of the current day realities, all combined, all mixed in, and with millions of people all coming at it from different perspectives. So it's all a big mix, you know, a big blender. And that's why you can't predict short-term returns, because this blender, it's got so many things mixed in, I don't think you can sort it out. But the long term, you can bet on that. I mean, you can't bet on it precisely, but in a general sense, you can figure out the probabilities. You can figure out where things are headed. You can figure out what the probabilities are of different long term outcomes. So, it gives the impression, if you live through it and you never sit back and study it, it gives the impression of a random number generator. You say, I thought it was going to go up and it went down. I thought it was going to go down and it went up. It seems like it's just random, but it's not random. It's always either momentum, or you could call it reversion to the mean, contrarian. It's always those two forces doing battle with each other, but who's going to win the battle on a daily basis is, in my opinion, totally unpredictable. I don't think you can predict it. But that doesn't mean it's random. It's not a random number generator. It's one of the two that applies. Or, you know, it's like a tug of war. If both sides are equally powerful at any given moment, you have a standstill. But it's never random. That's the error people make. They see that it seems unpredictable, and they conclude unpredictable equals random. But that's not right. It is unpredictable because I don't think there's any way to figure out which side's going to dominate in the short term. But while it may be unpredictable in the short term, it's not random. It's happening for a reason. And the reasons can be identified. All you have to do is look at the PE10 number. Whenever the PE10 is high, the long-term return is low. Whenever the PE10 is low, the long-term return is high. PE10 tells you the level of emotion in the market. It tells you where things are headed in the long term. And so it's not random. The mistake people make is they see that different things control at different times. What people want is a market that has only one factor influencing it. They want one thing to influence stock prices. And then everybody could just give one sentence. They could say, the market's always determined by momentum. However it's going, that's how it's going to continue to go. Or they could say, the market's always determined by reversion to the mean. Momentum has no influence, but that's false. Both, you have to understand, to understand today's stock price, you have to understand there's two competing forces, momentum and reversion to the mean. And it's the mix of those two that determines today's stock price. And past, present, and futures coming into play. And the past, present, and futures coming into play, it's not one past and one past, present, and one future. It's millions of them. All kinds of variations. That's why short-term prices are unpredictable. The number of factors is just beyond human calculation, in my assessment. But that doesn't mean the long-term, you see. Once you understand what the drivers are, you can then predict the long-term, not with precision, but you can predict long-term probabilities. And you get those probabilities on your side, and you're in good shape. So the bottom line on all that is there are no one-word answers. And what everyone seems to want are these one-word answers. What should I do with my money today? They know the today's price, and what would make people feel good is if you could tell them, do this, and in 3 months, this will be the result. And if you could get that right, boy, they nominate you, you know, Guru of the Year. What everybody wants is what we can't have. We have to start wanting something different, because we have wonderful information that can make all middle-class investors far more effective and allow you to retire many years sooner, 5 years sooner in the average case, I believe, maybe more. But you have to stop wanting to know what's going to happen in 3 months, because that's the one thing we can't know. We can't know what's going to happen in 3 months or 6 months or a year or 2 years. But in 5 years, I can give you a pretty good idea. In 10 years, I can give you a better idea. 15 years, I can give you a solid idea. And when you find out what's, you know, the way you know that is to look at that P10 number, look at the valuation, look at the price, because that tells you what's coming. That tells you, that doesn't tell you, that tells you what emotions are coming, you see? Because once the P10 level's sky high, you know that emotions are going to be turning bad, because that P10 level is going to ensure poor returns for many years, and emotions are going to sour over time. So you know the long term is looking bleak. I could tell you back in 1995 that the long term was looking bleak. Couldn't tell you when. Didn't start going down till 2000, but I could tell you the long term looked bleak. Very bleak. Today I can tell you the long term looks not too bad. Looks sort of good. That doesn't mean the short term's not going to be a killer. Probably is, because there are people today who are sticking with passive investing, people who haven't given up the ship. This is why capitulation is so important. We've got to wring out the emotion that drove that out-of-control bull market, and we haven't wrung it out yet. As long as people are arguing that passive investing makes sense, the emotion is still present, because there is no argument for passive investing. It's nutty. According to Warren Buffett, it's myth and urban legend, according to Robert Knott. We've got to wring out the nuttiness. When we wring out the nuttiness, then the past is behind us, and the emotion swings more to the future. People start thinking, hey, I don't care about losses, because all the people that had the losses that got killed, they're out. They sell. At capitulation, they all sell. The passive investors lock in their losses. And then the people in stocks are people that didn't lose. And then the dominant factor in setting the current day price is anticipation of future returns. And that gets returns going. That's exciting. You start from a P10 level of 7 when all the passive investors have given up and they're out of the market, and it's smooth. It's smooth sledding all the way. But we're not there yet. But we don't know what route we're going to take to get there. So, you know, I can't tell you, hold on until the passive investors get wrung out. If you do that, you're getting too cute. And you might miss some big gains. That's too cute. But what I can tell you is the probabilities. And go to the calculators for that. But generally, I'd say the probabilities today for those investing in stocks are, the long-term probabilities are pretty good. The short-term doesn't look so hot because there's still a lot of passive investors around, but the long term looks good. So you want to gradually be moving in the direction of stocks. And if we suffer another big price crash, if we go to a P10 level under 10, then you've got the opportunity of a lifetime, because then all of the people who remember how they destroyed themselves with passive investing are out of the market. And when those people are out of the market, all these bad memories aren't around to haunt us anymore. So today's price is a reflection of two factors, momentum and reversion to the mean, and which prevails is determined by millions of investors, each with a different perspective on three factors: their memory of the returns they've experienced over their investing lifetimes, their assessment of today's realities, and their anticipation of what they think is going to happen tomorrow. Bottom line on all this, we are the market. We set the price. There is no market in the sky. There's no machine in the sky setting the price. We do it. And we are not rational creatures. We have ration within it. We have reasoning within us. But we also have emotion. And the passive investing model ignores the emotion, which is the most important thing you need to learn about. You'll never understand stock investing, in Rob Bennett's opinion, if you don't understand that it's largely an emotional endeavor. And we're seeing a battle of emotions go on today and at all times. And looking at that snapshot, looking at the current day price, is just not that important. Just don't worry about it. It is what it is. If it goes up today, don't fall for these stories that, oh, this is a sign it's going to go up. And if it goes down today, don't fall for the story, this is a sign it's going to go down. Both claims are equally bogus. What you want to look at is, what is the PE10 level? That tells you where it's going, not in 3 months or 6 months or a year, but in the long term, 10 years, 5 years or 10 years, 15 years. And today, looks not too bad. Looks pretty good. My take on today is that you've got a good long-term return. It makes sense to be invested in stocks. You've got a real troublesome short-term. The next 5 years look brutal. But after we experience one more major stock crash, I believe, I'm seeing a weakening in the belief in passive investing. One more major stock crash should do it. And that'll free up the market to provide some really good returns. So take your focus away from today's stock price, which is set by emotions, memories, anticipations, and put your focus on the long term, where the economic realities prevail, and understanding the economic realities and counting on them instead of this emotional stuff puts the probabilities on your side. Have any thoughts? Shoot me an email. Look for the Contact Rob button at the left side of every page of the website. Good luck with your investing strategies. You take care.